I think I noticed that you had made a video at the beginning of the year, talking about your goals for the year 2023. How's that going? I mean, are you happy with the progress or?
Let me see what goals I had set. So let me pull that
So that
up.
is not a good sign, no? When you don't know your goal.
No, I do track them on the daily. But let's see. So I'm trying to like quantify the progress. Let's see if I have them up somewhere. So the first one is run, compete on Kaggle, read books, produce videos. I'd say I'm 60% through them. So yeah, I'm quite happy with it. Although I'm not going to compete on Kaggle as much as I want to. But just to give your audience some context, I started doing this ritual of sorts where I would like set a goal publicly every year at the beginning of every year and then give an objective review of it. So like a quantified objective review that, hey, these are my 7 goals. Here's the percentage success I had. The best I've had is like 60%. So obviously like I do a terrible job at setting the goals. But then since 2018 or 19, I've been setting these goals like every year. And then since I've like also gone on to like doing micro goals every few months here and there. So the end goal is just to like learn in public and sort of keep myself accountable to everyone.
I think I saw your video about last year as well, the goals that you had set last year. I thought it was pretty remarkable. I mean, the I think you had achieved almost 3/4 of what you wanted to achieve, and the things that you had missed as well, you had missed them, I think, by one or two. I think there was a kernel aspect or some notebooks aspect, and you had already published three, but you had set for four, so but you still had to reject that. I thought that was pretty cool, and
Yeah, no,
I
thanks. It's I usually I don't think it was 3/4. I think it was less than that. But it's again like it's so if I say like I want to do 6 of something and if I do 5 of them, it's like the goal is not complete, right? I can't say it's done. So that's what I meant by objectively reviewing them. So it's like it's either yes or no. There's like no in between, right?
Understood. On Kaggle, like, how did you get started with Kaggle? Like,
So Kaggle is this data sciencey platform that's known mostly for competitions, but there's like more aspects to it. They've added more aspects since it started, since at least I've been active on it. Not many people know this, so like this is the first time I'm revealing this. In gaming communities, it's known as like your profile suicide, where you basically delete your profile, right? So I started in 2015. But in 2017, I deleted my profile because I had like no hopes at all from Kaggle, like no aspirations. I thought this is beyond me. And then I found a course called Fast AI, which actually like taught us really how to like somewhat get around it, submit to competitions, compete on competitions. So the real start or restart sort of happened in late 2017 or 18.
in 2015, I mean, you had just signed up as like just to check out the platform, is it, or did you compete in it as well?
I tried the usual stuff. So there's like very famous competitions, the Titanic one, so on and so forth. 2015 was when I started my undergrad. So just out of curiosity, I heard, okay, there's something known as Kaggle. Let's check it out. I checked some notebooks out, like nothing, absolutely nothing made sense to me. So this was days of when pip install was also wasn't so convenient. And you had to like figure out ways of downloading the wheels and then installing them.
And what made you come back in 2017?
The FastAI course was pretty great at it. So they like really made it look feasible. Before that, like it just didn't feel possible at all.
Was FastAI the course that got you into deep learning as well, or was?
I would say I was interested in deep learning before that, but FastAI is what like got me hooked or got me like really started working for me as like a course or some material. Because even before that, I was like trying to do a lot of courses online, trying to like figure it out, but nothing was making sense. This is where like things started to click for me.
Oh, and your entry into deep learning, I mean, in the sense that how do you even get to know about it? Was it through a college course that you had taken, or?
No, so I made it a point to not pursue my passions through university. And I might need to explain that. So in right in the first semester, right, I was very passionate about computer science. I went to like study it. I assumed it'll be something which it wasn't. I was very disappointed with the system, with the curriculum and whatnot. So in my first semester itself, I sort of skimmed through the entirety of those syllabus that I was sort of interested in the entirety of those 4 years of undergrad that we have to go through. And I didn't like anything. So I made it a point that I'll go outside of this curriculum to search for my own curiosity and like find things that interest me, and made it a point, okay, this is like very outdated syllabus and it's going to ruin things for me. So anything that I actually like, I will not pursue here, and studied by myself. So I started like going to the internet, going to any random workshop I could, joining any student club I could, joining any online community that I could. So in this like discovery process, every undergrad in India, every engineering undergrad at least goes through a phase. You have to build a quadcopter. You start there in your engineering and then you go through these cycles. So I started with robotics, tried different things, tried app development as well for like a few weeks. Didn't like it, and eventually like found machine learning.
And once you did find it, was Fast AI the first thing that you found? Because I think even initially Fast AI did have a lot of popularity, in the sense that I think Jeremy had already won like Kaggle competitions, and you know, he did carry that he did have some authority when he made that course. And I would also say that I think the community aspect of Fast AI also was pretty strong from the get-go, in the sense that I think he was encouraging people to write about the course material or yeah. or some of the things that you might have learned in class. I think he was actively asking them to, he and his wife as well, I think, were both sharing, and they themselves were also writing their own blogs per se. So the way I'm thinking about this is, when I started learning deep learning, like I didn't know what to do. And then, like I had taken some like random courses, and then CS231 and then something else. And then maybe after like 4 or 5 random encounters, maybe, gone on to Fast AI, which I did not complete per se. So how was that for you? The discovery part of like learning, finding courses that really work for you.
I didn't know you had also taken Fast AI. That's really cool. But yeah, similar to yours, before Fast AI like went on this like random discovery. Fun fact, I've never, again, like another reveal that like I don't think I've ever said before, I've never completed Andrew Ng's any of those courses. I've like started them midway, I like lost interest, and I've like never, at least maybe it just like doesn't click for me, never had the courage to like really finish either the ML one or the deep learning one. Maybe that's why I'm so bad.
I think Andrew has a very, in my opinion, I think his teaching style is not very charismatic, in the sense that that's what I have noticed. I think this speaks to my bias of the teacher has to be engaging. And in my opinion, Andrew Ng is extremely knowledgeable, but I think through the videos, at least, like I'm not hooked. In the sense, like, you know how like a YouTube video or like a YouTube vlog or something, you know, you're just hooked from the get-go. Yeah. I did not find that, at least for me.
Yeah, I somewhat agree. Like the styles are different, like, right? Like Andrew's courses still feel like I'm listening to like a college lecture of sorts, and it's like a professor I'm listening to, and like, it's not someone like I can so much relate to, right? Like he definitely, like you feel respect for this authority. For like other stuff where I usually learn, like let's say Sendex's channel, it feels like I know that guy, right? Like I've been watching him since like days of GTFI video. It's like this cool guy that's somewhere in the world that makes this like cool project that he sort of teaches. So with him, you can sort of relate a bit more. It feels like just like style is slightly different. So like I basically agree with you.
But I think Sendex also, I would argue that Sendex got into teaching about deep learning a little late, no? I think 2018 or so, I think he started, if I'm not wrong. Is that fair? Or as per my recollection, he was a little late to the party, I think.
Yeah, but I think so too. But like his Python videos are also really what get you into Python, so to speak, right?
I agree with that, yeah. I think Python he was doing, I don't know, since 1991, I think. I don't know. But neural network wise, I think he was a little late. I think Andrew Karpathy had dominated that space pretty strongly in the beginning. And later on, I mean, I think there were other Stanford lecturers and MIT lecturers which popped onto the scene. But initially, I think Andrew kind of dominated that space. Yeah.
Yeah, Andre Karpathy's 2017 computer vision course is still one of the best Stanford courses I ever took. Like, I've not found a Stanford course that's like more engaging since. Like, I've taken a lot more since, but that was like the best Stanford MOOC that I had taken.
And I think he set the, what is that? I think he set the, like, not the bar, but the practice of sharing your lectures online. Like, even though that was done before, but I felt like, at least for the AI space, he, you know, set the standard that, you know, if you have some good, if you have some good lectures, it's best to share. And after that, a lot of lectures started popping onto the scene as well. You know, even from Stanford, and I think even the NLP classes also started open, like open sourcing their lectures, which were helpful as well. Yeah. How did you find your FastAI experience? Like, and did you finish the courses? How did you do the courses? How long were you involved in the course per se?
I would say I'm like still a student because I'm still involved in it. And I speak to Jeremy quite often. I have that like great opportunity. And I still say like I'm his worst student because I've like not completed the course since I took it in 2018, right? So it's like been what, 5 years, and I'm still like the worst student because this guy like never leaves the classroom, never sort of graduates. So I've written an article called How Not to Do FastAI, where I basically document my failures. And FastAI is like such a different experience, right? In the sense of it's top-down learning. In the sense, you like sort of have to put this blind faith in this person that has achieved so much. And he's saying that, okay, this we're going to follow this way of learning that you've never ever in your life probably seen before. Now maybe you have with like new courses. But at least at that time, like first time I ever saw top-down learning, applied learning. And he's saying it's okay not to know the theory. It's okay like not to understand everything. Just like mess around with this API, see what happens. We'll get to it later. And I was like defaulting every now and then to like the bottom-up learning, where I felt like, okay, he mentioned this word called segmentation. Let me go down that rabbit hole, eventually ending up again in like Andre Karpathy's course. Ending up in another subreddit where like they're discussing some paper, ending up in another discussion video about some paper, which basically like distracted me from actually following FastAI, right? Or like actually applying it, which is what the course sort of teaches. So like in retrospect, you need to have this like blind faith and just follow it how it's being suggested to be followed. And then things click more. But like I was like very confused by like what's going on. So I was like defaulting to my, so to speak, bad methods of learning, if I may.
I actually agree with you in the sense that I think Jeremy's course was like a fresh, like, you know, it was a novel thing where I think any other courses you would go to, I think they would start with you need to learn linear algebra, and you need to know a little bit of probability, you need to know a little bit of matrix math as well. And I think just listening to those prerequisites only, I think a lot of people would just, you know, man, fuck this. This is not for me. Yeah. By the time I learn this, I'm going to be like 50. But, you know, you would go to Jeremy's course and I think there would be a lot more open-mindedness and, you know, this faith that tinker with this now and then, we'll get to the parts. We'll get to the more interesting and, you know, how it actually works later on. And, you know, that faith, you need to have that faith to kind of progress in that curriculum as well. Starting, like, if you were to look back, and if somebody was to start, you think, deep learning today, like, how would you advise them to, like, you know, maybe traverse that path of finding the right stuff and maybe going about, like, what to learn, how to learn, and that process? How would you think about it today?
I don't know. Maybe I'm, like, too much at the cutting edge of large language models. I would just say, like, start by prompting, I don't know, GPT-4 or Claude 2, or I've played around with Palm. I don't think it's like at that level. Maybe like either of these three. Start there, look at the papers, look at how these are being applied, look at all the like trending repositories. Pretty much all of them are like GPT applications. Start there, because I feel like these are so good that they really trump all of the tutorials, in the sense, you know, you'd like the first tutorial sort of say take up in segmentation is like I don't know, object detection in a video or something like that, right? And now you can just like connect an external module to even ChatGPT, GPT 3.5, a vision module, and have it reason over that also, so that like immediately outperforms the old tutorial even in that sense with just like a few lines of code.
Why did you say Palm is not that great? Like, can you maybe elaborate a little bit on that?
Maybe I'm too much in the roots, but I like, so for context, I prompt or talk to these models. I have no life. I prompt or talk to these models like about 2 hours at least every day, been reading a lot of papers. So in my sort of interactions or trying to get it to do things, it didn't feel at a level of at least GPT-4 or even Claude 1.3 in my tests. Like the responses weren't as nuanced or as rich in my experience.
And you're prompting them stuff like?
So what I do with these models is basically like help me understand research or understand code or write code. Most of it is this, and then there's like random curious thoughts, like I'm trying to think of something I had recently. I don't know, I was like, today I was trying to figure out if it makes more sense to exercise in one interval or do it like spread out throughout the day. And like, this is like classic LLM example, right? And you like try to get it to give facts. So such stuff.
I think for Claude model, you have to get access, no? I think you have to apply. It's not like OpenAI where they have like a UI interface where you can just make an account and start chatting with talking to ChatGPT per se, right? Claude, I think you need access.
Claude 2 is now publicly available in the US and UK.
You're using VPN to access that, is it?
I have had access before, so for some reason it works for me. But you can use it through VPN is what I've been told.
Okay. Because I tried using, I wanted to use the 100K context model, but they asked me to sign up and, and
they never get back. Yeah, it's like so secretive, right? Like it's, I don't know what they're hiding. Like everyone I know, they've like signed up and they just don't like hear back. I don't know what's going on behind the scenes.
Yeah, it's been like 3-4 weeks now since I signed up for that form. And no response. Palm, though, I don't even know where to begin. So, I don't know much about Palm.
How's your experience been with LLMs otherwise? Do you like use GPT-4 a lot or?
So I used to be a subscriber. I wanted to test out GPT-4. So I subscribed for a month. The problem was that even after, so the most annoying part for me was even after I had paid like 1600 rupees, which is, I think, $20. If you ask anything to GPT-4, you would get only like 20 questions. Like you could only ask like 20 queries, which became really annoying in the sense that, so I was doing mental calculations as to, is this question important enough for me to ask GPT-4? Or is there a more important question I will figure out in the future? So I was always doing that calculus. And most of the times I would not even use GPT-4. And I would always end up defaulting to 3.5. So I was like, fuck it, man. Like, why am I paying if I'm only getting like answers from 4? To answer your question, I found it I was really extremely impressed with GPT 3.5, even GPT 3. Like the nuance in the answers and the and just the answers, right? Like very, I found them pretty impressive. And even while researching for podcasts or just for some concepts, in some ways it was even better than going through Google search and, you know, getting through links and going through a specific website. So I found it very, very informative. Claude, I have not tested. I wanted to. So one application I really enjoy, which I want, is book summarization, which I have not been able to do even by GPT 3.5. That's what I was hoping to do on Claude, but I have not been able to do it. We'll come back to LLMs, I think, but I want to maybe go back to Kaggle competition for a second. You're a discussion grandmaster, if I'm not wrong.
Yes, but you have done the easiest category.
But you have done competitions as well. And I think your best performance is 7th place at a competition, if I'm not wrong.
Yes.
Right. Like, how do you prefer? I mean, when you were competing, and I don't know if you're competing still, but like what is your MO when you prepare for a Kaggle competition? Like one is, can you just walk through the process of maybe even starting from like when to figure out when to build it, like when to join a team and, you know, how to work in that team as well. Also your process of how you work and what you do per se.
Sure. So I've also asked this question to a lot of people, and every response is very different. So like everyone has their own approach. And from what I know, there's like no right or wrong approach. The seventh position was like a long time ago. I think that was 2018 or 19. My recent best finish was 20, I think. Top 20 in a team, in a competition that ended in September last year. And that's not gold. So that's a silver, team silver medal. But my approach is sort of just teaming up with people I know or I respect. So either through Kaggle or otherwise. For approaching any competition,
I'm so sorry. So, but I mean, when you say you want to join a team of respected people, but in the sense that, I mean, so the thing is, they also would want to, like, you know, it's a problem where, let's say there's an amazing team and I want to join them, but they also should want me to join them. So how is that convincing phase? Like, do you just reach out to people saying, you know, this is my background and this is what I do? Like, how is that process?
The Kaggle community is quite tightly knitted together. So sort of like everyone knows each other in different ways. That helps. For me, I would... yeah, it's like a both way thing. But I would reach out to friends of mine through the community. So like I've repeatedly teamed up with a few folks. Or let's say I know someone who's on the leaderboard and I'm close to them, I'd probably team up with them. Although I don't think I've done that recently, at least to my knowledge.
Okay. I cut you off when you were talking about your process for, I don't know, yeah.
Yeah, so recently I've like sort of taken a Kaggle break because LLM stuff is more exciting. Now I'm looking at coming back for the like LLM competition that's happening. So process of deciding is just like completely curiosity based. If like it at all interests me or it like piques my interest in any way, if I find that like challenging in a direction that I want to sort of learn about, I'd pick that competition. And then how I'd approach it would be just like go to public notebooks or start reading about older competitions. And people actually like found this really useful to like go through older competitions. So I did this like series of live streams where I would like go through older competitions and like help others understand top solutions. So top solutions are really helpful with from any competition, even like 3-4 years ago. So I did that live stream thing also for like a really long time. I think I did about 20 or 30 live streams. So I'd look at the top solutions, try to figure some idea out from there, look at recent notebooks and start messing around. That's where you like start getting on the leaderboard, hopefully start climbing up. And around that point, I would like team up. So I prefer teaming up early than later. People that are shooting for points or shooting for medals like to team up later. I like to optimize for learning. So if I'm competing now, I'd probably team up earlier than later so that I can like interact with the other people more, learn more through them.
How much time do you generally, is one of the reasons why you stopped competing is because is this too much time consuming?
No, I don't find it time consuming, right? So like for me, I'm like very passionate about anything I pursue. So like, it's like binary for me. If I'm interested, I'd pursue it. If it's not, then I wouldn't. And then I don't care about how much time it takes.
Yeah. Understood. What about the prize money in the sense that, I think last time I was on Kaggle, the last competition at least I remember vividly is the Data Science Bowl, the Nucleus segmentation, I think, which happened in 2018, if I'm not wrong. I think they had a prize money of $100,000. Like, has the prize money pool like increased over time or decreased over time, you would say, because of the interest and competition?
Varies with competition to competition, but I can guarantee you that someone who's on the top of the leaderboard, assuming they're from the US or Europe, they probably, even if they win or if even if their team wins like a prize, first place prize of 50K or something like that, I'm sure like they're much more capable than that. So that's not the most exciting thing for, I'm sure, pretty much all of us. So anyone who's competing, I've never won prize money. I don't foresee myself ever winning prize money. It's like incredibly hard to do that. So like it takes mad skills to even think of it, if I may. But I know most people are aiming for learning or like trying to understand a problem type or trying to go in there with an agenda to like, let's say, I know at H2O people compete in a competition with an agenda of, okay, I'll just compete with, let's say, this model this time. Let's say, I don't know, GNNs to a certain problem type, for example.
I think part of the reason why I brought that up was because I think in that same competition, there was one of the discussions which was talking about the bubble of data science, which had like kind of burst, because I think on the previous year or the previous in the previous 2 years, I think the prize money was about $1 million for the data science ball, and it was significantly reduced to $100,000. So you know, there was some speculation that the trend of paying extremely high amount of money for competitions, that phase is over, and now we will start to normalize, you know, $100,000, $50,000, $25,000, and that's going to be like the new normal, and not like, you know, $1 million for a competition. I think, you know, that that phase is like over, and I think rightfully so, right? I don't think we get to see a lot of competitions where the prize pool is north of $500,000 or north of $100,000. Is that fair?
We had a few after that as well, to my knowledge. So there was the deepfake competition, which I think was $1 million prize pool. I need to check, but I think that was quite high in that sense. Then recently also there was like a scroll, historic scroll detection, something like that, which again had $1 million prize pool. So I don't know if I necessarily agree with that statement, and I don't feel like there's any bubble being burst here. I think it just like varies. I also know like behind the scenes what happens at Kaggle a bit. So it just like depends on the organizer to organizer and also like the goals at Kaggle, which I don't think have changed significantly, at least in the past few years.
How do you look at the conversion of Kaggle competitions and maybe the results of those competitions to like real world problems, in the sense, if you were running a contest on Kaggle, how much do you think it would impact the winning model? How much do you think it would impact like your own business? Or do you think even after you get the new model, there is a lot of work to be done to maybe fine tune it or to bring it like use case it to your particular use case?
That's a great question. And I also used to ask that question a lot when I used to interview Kagglers. But over time, I've sort of learned that that is not the right question to ask per se, right? Because there's no single model answer to any problem type, right? Over time, you can't like just deploy one model and you're good for life, right? You have to retrain it, look for data shifts, keep an eye out on how it's performing, all those things. So the way I look at it is, you're sort of, let's say, with a prize pool of even 100k or 50k, let's say. With 50k, you're inviting 1,000 participants, out of which 200 will be very engaged, to look at this problem type, approach it, try to solve it, and share their insights. So as an organizer, you get access to like the winning solutions, where you have like the complete insight of how they are being built. But inside of there, you also get exposed to all these discussions and tricks and ideas, right, that everyone is sort of sharing. So if you saw that clip of Karpathy that was recently shared around agents, AI agents, he mentioned something in passing in that video, right, which was that whenever a new paper along transformers or training transformers comes out, anyone at OpenAI instantly goes, oh yeah, we tried that like 3 years ago and we know how that works. That's not effective. So it's again these tricks that you experiment with, right, are not the end result, so to speak.
How much do you like to spend a lot of time on experimentation, like in terms of like competition wise, or does that get annoying for you?
No, if I'm competing, I quite enjoy it. For the last competition I took part in, my good friend Crowdog, his Kaggle username is Crowdog. He goes by Andrea. We trained models for 5,000 or 6,000 GPU hours. Between the both of us, we were like really enjoying that. I was like sort of keeping an eye out and keeping track of all experiments in that sense. So like to put the number in perspective, that's like in a 2.5 month period, right? So many GPU hours being spent. So in that sense, I sort of enjoy it. And it's also part of the process. nowadays, at least since Feb or March, I've just been experimenting with LLMs and just trying to play with APIs, prompt these, or build on top of these.
So on the GPU, when you mentioned you had spent about 6,000 hours for just experimenting, I remember going back to, let's say, 2017, 2018, GPU was a big constraint in the sense that it was very difficult to train. It was very difficult to kind of train models or even find GPUs, in the sense that training was very difficult. And GPU was like a big constraint. Today, it's like when you talk about GPU constraints, you're talking about number of GPUs to train. People want like thousands of GPUs. That's a constraint. What do you think is like a constraint today in the sense, are we still at GPU constraint where it's difficult for new people to come train models? Is that the biggest constraint, or do you see some other constraints which might be bigger than, let's say, GPU per se?
That's a great question. And the GPU constraint, so to speak, hasn't gone away. But even in 2017, even today, we have people that are very creative with these approaches. I'm not saying for that competition, although it was like kind of necessary, but you don't always need compute for competitions. You can, if you're very smart and very good at it, you can get your way around with just using Colab as well. And people have won competitions, won gold medals with that. I don't know. I still feel like the constraint today isn't GPUs. It's just your creativity or how effective you are with these things. All of us work with our own constraints, right? And now that everyone has access to Google Colab or Kaggle kernels that have a 16 gig GPU, I don't know what they're providing. How are you standing out from everyone now? Because everyone has that, right? And at least in a competitive sense, or especially competitions, what's your edge then if everyone has access to that? So it could be compute, it could be your creativity, it could be your experience, could be a combination of all of these. Totally depends.
Yeah, I mean, I think early on, it would be difficult. I mean, I think even Google Colab and even Kaggle kernels, I think, started, I think, around 2018, 2019. So before that, it was very difficult in the sense that I think even ResNets. So nowadays, what you have is, I think, models have gotten very compact. There is always this lighter, even if it's a bigger model, you have lighter version of that model which you can run, let's say, on one GPU. But I think before that, you would need at least 8 GB memory, 8 gigs memory, or more than that, 16 gigs memory to run proper models. Now that compute, at least to get started, I think that compute element has, you can easily set up a Google Colab and just get quickly started and, maybe see how a ResNet works, or, just get some classification output or even object detection output. But before, I think it was a little complicated. You had to have access to GPUs, and that was also a huge barrier to entry. Even if you know the theory, you don't know how to set up, let's say, CUDA-NN, or it became a huge issue. Yeah.
Even then, that wasn't the end of it, right? You needed to figure out where to download model weights from, how to set them up, how to load them properly, and then figure out if you had the right dependencies installed in the first place. And you couldn't import from Hugging Face Hub or TIM, for that matter.
Right. Now that you mentioned that, I also remember language problems as well. I think at least when I was doing it, I think I had started off with Caffe, if you remember. And Caffe was a huge pain for me. You had to get those proto.txt files, proto.txt files. It was easy, but I think it was only very helpful for classification networks. And I think vision problems, it was very helpful. For NLP, it was, for LSTM, it was a bit of a pain. PyTorch wasn't even there, I think. I mean, PyTorch only started, I think, in 2017. So the language ecosystem also was evolving. That also, TensorFlow was not easy at all, at least in my opinion. It was a bit of a pain as well.
Still is.
Even with I've not used it for some time now, but even after you're saying that even after 2.0, I heard things got a lot better after 2.0.
I'm just being sort of salty, but I think with Keras it's easy. But if you just default to just raw TensorFlow, it's still can be I'm trying to be polite, it still can be challenging.
Were you surprised with the way PyTorch came in? And I thought it quickly grabbed the market share of the language. I think before PyTorch, I think TensorFlow was seriously like very like it was dominating very heavily. But I thought PyTorch was very quick. I think they launched and then pretty quickly researchers adopted it very fast. But maybe in companies they have not adopted it as because of production issues. But I thought it took the market share away pretty quickly. And I think a lot of research papers which come in, most of their code deployment happens in PyTorch, if I'm not wrong, rather than TensorFlow. Yeah, were you surprised by that? Like the way they took over the.
No, because I wasn't like at the top of everything at that point, right? I was just starting out. So for me, like everything was the same. And I didn't care if it's like PyTorch or some new framework that just came out. So for me, it was just like, which path do I take to learn?
Understood. Okay. You're currently working at H2O, if I'm not wrong. Can you talk a little bit about H2O, like what it does and what you do maybe in H2O as well?
Sure. So H2O is the team, one of the teams that we're very well known for is the team of the largest Kaggle Grandmaster group. They happen to work here. So that's really nice in the sense we all sort of speak a similar language, although others are much, much higher up on the leaderboard. They're much more knowledgeable, but everyone's very humble. So you get to collaborate with these grandmasters at work as well. And what we do as an organization is we democratize AI by making automated machine learning tools, sort of end-to-end AI or ML products that help right from the level of junior data scientists to senior data scientists work on different problems. These could be tabular problems. This could be OCR problems. These could be deep learning problems. And for all of these, we have different products that we sort of sell to enterprises. Beyond that, we're also like very well known for being the first in the open source space to build H2O3, which is still one of the best open source AutoML frameworks. And recently, we've also open sourced a lot of LLMs, a lot of fine-tuned LLMs. We've created one of the best tools to fine-tune your own LLM, which is a no-code GUI tool. So broadly speaking, that's what we do as an organization. My work, it's a startup, so it keeps shifting a lot from time to time. Right now, there's quite a bit of customer-facing focus, helping customers understand our products, use them better, engaging with them in different capacities, along with also growing the open source community, creating content. So mix of all of these things.
The hiring of, as you mentioned, I think has the world's largest number of grandmasters working mm-hmm. in one company. Like, any rationale behind that? Like, I mean, was it a conscious decision to hire Kagglers or was that just accidental where you're looking for the best people and they just happen to be at Kaggle?
No, it was a conscious decision. Our founder, Shri Ambate, is very forward-looking. He's very well known as a visionary in the field. And he picked up on this aspect in 2016, even before the Grandmaster tier existed, right? So you just had Masters until then. He sort of figured out that people who are good at these competitions are great data scientists. And that trend sort of picked up even before it became a trend. So he sort of created this mission of sorts.
The company is based out of the US, no? Or
yes.
Right. You're working, I assume you're working remotely.
Yes, I've been all my career I've been working remotely since 2017, and I prefer working remotely. So I work from Dehradun, which is why everyone sees those LLM papers and mountains.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I've seen some of your Twitter pics as well. Actually, even I was a little conflicted. I was a little surprised, like, because I think on your LinkedIn, it mentions Bangalore, urban India. And I was thinking, like, where in Bangalore is he finding these? Is he finding these mountains? I was really surprised.
Are you in Bangalore?
I'm from Bangalore. Yeah, so I'm currently living in Bangalore. So that's why I was very surprised. Like, where is this? Have I not been here? Anyways, yeah. How do you find working remotely? Like, is it what do you think are the pros? You seem to really prefer it.
I don't know otherwise, right? So I only know this way. I have like peaks into working from offices when I like visit customer locations or have friends that work out from offices. Over time, I've like grown very comfortable with my preferences, right? So I have like a widescreen monitor there. I have a curved monitor there. I'm replacing that with an OLED. I have this chair built right to my configuration. The lighting is set to my preference. So it like lights the table in a certain way that makes me feel productive. I can put my plants around. I can have my bookshelf there if I want to access stuff. You can't get this in an office, right? It's also like, I understand it's not an option for everyone. But if I have the option, I would, I'm sure everyone would prefer this, right? And at least for me, it makes me feel more productive. Even you're if you're like...
You're at your room? Are you staying with family? Or is this like a... Have you taken like a place?
This is my apartment. So I stay with my family. But yes, this is the chai office.
This is the... Okay. What about the system on your right, I think?
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk? Can you give us the? Are you able to share the?
Oh yeah, I thought there's a follow up coming. Right now, let's see. I keep changing the config. So right now it has 4 GPUs inside of it, all air cooled. 2 3090s, 1 A6000, 1 Titan. So that is the main deep learning rig. I never plug my monitor into it. There's another one underneath. So that has 1 3090 in it, and that is just for stable diffusion experiments or stuff like that, and occasional gaming. I use the smaller one for that. This is for all the deep learning workloads.
And how much memory do you have totally there on the top one?
Do you mean memory or GPU memory?
GPU memory, yeah.
Let's see, 48 plus 48, 96 plus 24, 120 gigs.
Okay. And you're constantly running experiments, is it? Like you're always buzzing at night or something? I don't know.
Not so much these days, although like it's just the occasion. Like right now I have some local LLMs running. They're not doing inference. But if I want to kick inference off just for the sake of my comparison, I can like go to the local host, port forwarded port, and just like kick it off. So it's like always on in that sense. It has something in memory, not necessarily running nowadays. When I would Kaggle, yes, this room would be really hot and the air conditioning would be on all the time. So yeah.
Did you think of making like a server room or something like that, or maybe placing the GPUs
This is that.
This is the server room, is it?
This is that, yes.
In the sense, you never thought of, like, since you work out of here as well, maybe keeping the GPUs outside or where you're not very it tends to get hot, so you didn't think of
yeah,
that
because it's like a both of the systems combined is like a 2000 watt heater in a sense, right? But it's still manageable, so I quite like it here. It also, like, I like looking at it. So I would sit half of my day here reading papers, and I'd look at it when I'm not like going outside reading papers. So I prefer it here. This is all planned. And even like this like preference of having this right here, right, is also like something I enjoy being able to do remotely.
And when you're working, I can see the two monitors. So do you like have both your work set up and both the monitors, or how do you work in the sense? How do you split your monitor work?
So that's the bifurcation for more of my like mental modes. So this side is for work and that side is for gaming. So when I'm sitting on that side, I like sort of have over time just like made that side for gaming. So if I'm sitting on that side, my brain should ideally go into relaxation mode. That side is working mode. So whenever I'm on that side, don't watch YouTube videos, don't play games, don't look at the phone. This side, do whatever.
I actually tried that. So I really wanted to get two monitors, but at this point I'm stuck with one. But I don't have the table space for that as well. But what I used to do is I used to try watching, like, I would use my laptop only for work stuff. And if I had to like go for entertainment, I would take my phone and just maybe watch YouTube only on like my phone. But eventually it gets tiring because you want the bigger,
yes,
you know, display. So I couldn't keep that up, but I was trying to bifurcate that way, but unsuccessfully. Yeah. You also spoke about your...
Sorry?
I'm just sorry. You were saying...
Yeah, I was saying I've been wanting to get the Odyssey G9 for a while, and they just came out with the Odyssey G9 OLED. So that's like a 49-inch ultra wide. But then it's kind of ridiculously expensive. So I'm thinking of getting just like a OLED TV as a monitor, still thinking about that. Although I've been, sorry.
But TV as a monitor does not really work well. No, that's what I've heard, because I tried plugging in my laptop on my home TV. The resolution or the DPI apparently was very bad, and I was not getting the. It was not very comfortable at all.
Do you have an OLED?
I'm not sure actually. I'm not sure. It was a 4K monitor.
Yeah, but OLEDs really, like, I've at least in my test, OLED are like where it becomes feasible, because like it's the image quality really like starts to become really good.
Okay, okay. I'm not sure if my home TV is OLED, but I remember trying to plug my laptop in. It was not very. It was not even the mouse movement, right? Mm-hmm. The movement of the mouse was very blurry, and there was a lot of delay as well. So I didn't use it. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. What about your chair, though?
Yeah, so I've gone through a lot of chairs. I don't remember which brand this is, but this is the one I found most comfortable recently. So I've gone.
You said
through...
you had it customized?
No, I did not. No.
Okay. Okay. Okay.
Yeah, just the like setup and like my preferences, like the lighting and whatnot, right? Because I live stream a lot, so there's like a right here up on top. I used to have this, which is like a key light. I don't need it anymore. I just have it in my office as backup. But then even the ability to have these like lights set up in a custom way, right? That can like make me light up. And it's just like one switch that has everything ready to go. So for that reason, I prefer working remotely.
Okay. And I think now that you've really established like this perfect environment for you to, I think you'll be here your entire life or, you know, for a significant amount of time. It seems that way.
No, it's part of being, as we call the PC master race, right? You're never happy. I'm like, I've just bought more RAM for this, upgraded its SSD thrice, that one's twice in the last month. So you're like never really happy in that sense. Keep changing things out. So it's like never a complete project in that sense. But yeah, I don't know. I'm like flexible about that. I like this setup. Not married to it, but I quite like it.
We've spoken about all your equipments, but I'm curious about your laptop. Like what laptop do you use and how many laptops do you use?
So the one I'm using right now is a M1 Max. And this is, I daily this.
The Pro or the basic one?
It's the Pro with the Max chip.
Oh, okay. Oh, M1 Max, is it? Okay,
yes.
Okay. Okay, okay. How are you finding that?
So I find people say you don't really need to go from Pro to Max. But what I do, at least for the video you mentioned, the goals video, there I had... really to get into the roots of video editing, I had like 5 layers of 4K animation and 3 layers, 1 layer of animation, 3 layers of videos playing in parallel. Any other, even though I found the Pro chip to also like start to stutter there or heat up a lot, this one doesn't. So for those purposes, this is really good. Like editing videos, it's really good.
Mm-hmm. Working remotely, one issue I at least find is it gets boring now and then, or most of the time. So how is that for you though? How do you, like, is that a big issue for you? Or what is the big issue for you if you're working remotely?
I have thought about it a lot, right? So even if you go to office, it's like not, maybe it is, but I would assume it's not all of your friends aren't there, and then you have to interact with some people that might be unpleasant, right? So it might in that sense also not be the best experience, at least in Bangalore, right? It takes like, it's so ridiculous. I'll never wrap my head around it. 10 kilometers take 1 hour at the minimum, assuming you're not going from one locality to another. All that time is saved. On the flip side, you lose out on the social side, so you have to like come up with conscious effort to sort of make up for it. With my free time, I like going out in the nature, usually take papers with me, go to any random cafes. There's like any cafe here is scenic for an outsider looking in, right? So like you said, it's like scenic for you. For me, it's like, is this a cafe? Because these are all the cafes I've seen. If I go to Bangalore, it's like, okay, this is a different experience, because it's like so it's like a concrete jungle or this like so jam-packed. That's a different cafe for me. For me, normal cafe usually overlooks something very scenic. I'd go there, read a paper, get out every day, possibly every other day.
How is the social life in Dehradun?
So I grew up in the city. In that sense, I have a bit of a graph here, although not I'd say none of the people here are in tech at all.
Okay.
So that's a different experience.
Is it because they migrate as soon as they...
I think so. Either they migrate or just the city has no... Maybe it does. Maybe I've not met anyone. But there's no like... even software engineers, I haven't run into as many here.
Which comes to like, what was your decision to like really, you know, stick to remote? Like generally people want to move away from their homes or, you know, explore new cities. What made you like, you know, really double down on remote maybe? Is it just the companies that you ended up getting or the freelance work that you got, which never really gave you the opportunity to?
So I have explored other cities as well, right? Not that I've lived here all my life. I've traveled a fair bit as well. And then I quite prefer this way of living. Like I said, this office setup, I can set it up in a way I like. Even this city where I live in, as a city, I really like it in the sense it's like any mountain range from here is like half an hour. Of a drive from my house, at least I can go drive in any direction, end up in nature. Any direction if I drive in, there's nature. Half an hour away, proper forest or proper mountains. So I quite prefer that. And over the years, I've like traveled a fair bit, so I quite like it here compared to everywhere I've been.
I think one of your tweets is about how you had traveled for like 40. Different time zones, or I don't recall exactly in the past year or so. I don't know. Yeah.
I changed my time zone 14 times in like 40 days last year.
Was it due to like work-wise, or you were just attending conferences, or what was the nature?
Conferences for work. So, yeah.
Okay.
But there's like not all work, right? Of course, if you go to a different country for a conference, you're going to do touristy stuff. So mix up both.
Understood. I want to go to, you have a pile of papers on your left, I think. I want to discuss a little bit about upskilling, or, you know, upskilling is a strong word, but just staying up with new stuff, or understanding new things, or staying at the bleeding edge of tech or deep learning. So let's start with papers, I think. How many papers? So why do you read papers? How is reading papers useful, and how many papers you might read, let's say, in a week?
Great question. For usually, historically, it's like been completely irrelevant, right? To read papers, you might not learn the applied knowledge, maybe very much so, like 10% of the knowledge becomes applied. With LLMs, it's like a different landscape, right? Because like the applied research and even bleeding edge overlaps so much that it's like sort of necessary in that sense, because a lot of these papers are just talking about prompting, which you can fire up GPT 3.5, anyone can, and you can test that technique if it works, or you can use the API, connect a vision module, see if that works. So in that aspect, I think reading papers is good, but before that, make sure you've like played around with the API, applied it. There's a really great cookbook. Play around with open source LLMs. There's H2O GPT. It's also for free. You can also try it for free. You can download it, run it. Once you've done that, papers can be helpful. I've been writing paper summaries every day for at least, I think, more than 100, more than 150 days now. The reason why I do it is I quite like to stay on top of the LLM research. It's some topic that like really excites me. Excites me more than anything else in deep learning ever did historically. I still don't understand why. How many papers do I read in a week? I read like 5 to 8 papers every day. If I don't in one day, I like sort of pick up the next day, so like I try to catch up with that. So I don't know how many that becomes in a week, but quite a few.
5 to 8 every day.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the, like, how do you go about reading a paper? Like, I mean, can you walk us through that? Like which aspects do you double down, and is there like when you're reading a paper, do you also, let's say there's a reference made, do you go back to a different paper then, or do you just stick to this paper? So can you just walk us through the process as well?
Sure. So when I say read, I actually read these. I skim through more, but I actually read these cover to cover. 5 to 8, I probably skim much more than that. I start by going through the introduction and then the conclusion. If I like those, then I start going through the paper. With LLMs, the papers are so similar that I've like sort of gotten really fast at it. I sort of know what to expect, have started recognizing benchmarks. And in my experience, there's like no way around it. So I have to like go through a lot of papers to become good at it, or fast at it at least. I don't think I'm really good at it. Still figuring out how to effectively pass through them. What I look for in a paper is also very curiosity driven. So any paper summary I write out of, I'm of course not sharing all the papers I read, right? So any paper I write is the one I really liked. And it's, again, like completely dependent on my own interest, in the sense I found a technique to be really cool. I'm trying to think of one that came up recently. Maybe it's an architecture, maybe it's a prompting technique, maybe how you're connecting these models together, stuff like that. So for example, today I read about how you can sort of do prompt boosting. So instead of XGBoost, you prompt a model to summarize tabular data and then put it into Ada Boost and run a model through that, predictive model through that. So that was a cool paper I found today. But again, very, very random, very, very much all over the place.
And when do you, like, do you, these 5 to 8 papers or more than that, is there like, do you schedule a time where, you know, let's say, maybe early mornings, or, you know, maybe once you wake up, the first thing you like to do is maybe, let's say, read a paper, or do you spread those across chunks, or how does that work for you?
Depends on the mood as well, honestly speaking, but ideally, under the most ideal circumstances, I wake up early, so around 5, sometimes earlier than that, spend the first few hours reading the papers that I have in my list. And I missed a question from earlier, which was if I go through the reference graph. No, I don't. But I make notes if I like, if there's like a very strong reference and that looks really cool, I'd make a point, add it to my list, and then like get around to reading the paper later on. Most of the times I don't, because the list keeps growing. But yeah, ideally start in the morning, read some papers. Then once I'm done with my day, I'd probably go out and read some more outside.
And finding these papers is, I would assume, like one way is obviously references of the paper that you're currently reading will have some like new papers to read. Apart from that, is that the way you discover new papers, or?
There's like many people that tweet about papers. So I check out every paper. AK tweets about, there's like a link as well on Hugging Face now. I follow that. There's Reddit. There are different lists. There's papers with code. And I do check all of these things quite regularly. So it like comes from all of these streams sort of daily.
So one issue that I have, not issue, but in the sense, one thing I'm curious about is the rate of revolutionary papers or papers with significant contributions happen very, infrequently, like very rarely. Like a technique which is really revolutionary, or an architecture which is really pushing the state of the art, may happen, I don't know, maybe in deep learning case once in 6 months or once in a year per se. But you are going through papers very aggressively on a daily basis. So do you feel like most of the papers that you read are not really adding a lot of value to you as well?
That's a great question. I'm trying to think if they do or if they do not. So I think for the papers that I skim and choose not to read, I found them like to be very, very minimal, minimally influential. But at least in LLM space, there's so much to go through, right? So I'm still going through the historic pile of, let's say today I read Flan T5, and before that yesterday or last week, I think I was going through the Instruct GPT. So even these influential papers are so many, and you can still learn so much that there's still so much to go through. And then even with the everyday papers, Claude 2 came out 3 days ago. Its model card is a technical report, which I went through. I learned some things there about how they actually improved, stuff like that. So like my baseline has sort of shifted in the sense I'm not looking for SOTA, I'm just looking for techniques or ideas to stay informed about. So that's what I currently seek through papers and not necessarily like a great benchmark or breakthrough.
What is the best paper you've read? Do you have like a paper that you feel is like completely blew your mind and you know?
PJ Reddy had written this like really famous, really funny YOLO paper. I don't know if you remember. So that's the best ML paper ever written, in my opinion.
Okay. When you read, I'm curious about, has there been like, once you've read these papers, has there been a situation where you've read something and you've gone to the, let's say, you've applied that technique or that architecture and suddenly there's been like, there's a huge improvement in, let's say, either your company or something that you're working on? Has there been cases like that?
I'm trying to think. Maybe for competitions, I haven't worked on products so much. I built on top of our open source products, but it's not like those are more demos than products. For Kaggle competitions, I found such instances, especially in the last one that we were going through, we had this happen a few times. So in that sense, yes.
Okay. Ford, do you think that papers is the best way, or do you think, or maybe watching YouTube videos or maybe reading blog posts is, do you think that's a decent or a better alternative than to reading the papers itself, or do you think there's no shortcut to that?
I think there's no right answer to it. So papers eventually become API calls. API calls eventually become hidden API calls in the sense you call the next top level API and that calls the underlying API itself. So if you don't care about being at the cutting edge, you can just wait for PyTorch to have that, or whatever LLM torch comes out eventually will have that. If you enjoy learning through videos, go do that. There's this preferential bias as well, right? If like, let's say you're trying to buy a car and you go ask someone who's bought 50 cars, do you recommend buying a car? They won't say no, right? Same for like machine learning. That's where I'm going with this. So if you go to someone who's done a master's, if you ask them, should I do a master's? They will say yes because they did it. Maybe they don't know. Very unlikely scenario. Most of the times they say yes. Ask a PhD student, should I do a PhD? Most likely they'll say yes. So after that, it becomes a question of how influential or how good of a speaker they are in their convincing skills, that maybe I'm even to convince you, Ryan, that you should read papers, and then you get so strongly convinced and you do that for a few weeks and figure out it's not for you. So I'm quite averse to advice being given. So I prefer stumbling my way through different scenarios. I think that's a better strategy. And that's what I suggest, is you optimize for your own fun and figure out what clicks for you.
Understood. I want to focus on LLM for a second. So can you tell us like what is an LLM and how did you get involved in, let's say, reading a lot of papers in LLM or just tinkering with LLMs?
Sure. I don't know the exact definition of the community has ever agreed on one, but any model that starts to show these emergent abilities is broadly known as a large language model. I think that's the consensus. So emergent abilities are abilities where they've not been trained on something, but they start to show that ideology. So for example, ChatGPT is a next word prediction model that has also been fine-tuned on other stuff. But along its training, maybe it was never taught how to think rationally, and over time, somewhere along the training pipeline, it's able to think rationally or come up with some logic, flawed logic, whatever. That's LLM. When this happened, when ChatGPT came out, and that's one of my regrets. I was like really traveling at that point. So I thought again, it's like DALL-E hype that will eventually die out, because I saw DALL-E, I tried it quite extensively. And I was like, this model isn't really cool at all, right? It's like the outputs are just like GANs from 2016. So I just assumed it's something like that. And I completely missed that hype. when I did a NLP reading group with someone from Hugging Face Lewis, he's very well known in the community. Even at that time, I was skeptical. I was like, what's interesting here? I actually asked him this question, which is like, they just made a bigger model, trained it with more data. What's really influential here, right? And then I learned there's like four levels of playing with LLMs. You have this like first level that I just described, which is like, there's nothing new here, right? And then when you actually like play around with it, you realize maybe it's cool. Then you start thinking, okay, this is actually something. And then you realize it's like, it's actually really good and you should try shifting your experiments there. So over time, I like stumbled onto level four, which I just said. And this happened around Feb or March, since when I like started completely following the space. In May, I took a vacation. And just for fun, I like setting goals. I said, okay, I'll write about one paper every day and build one app every day. And I called it a LLM vacation. And that sort of picked interest. And just for fun, I said, okay, I'll hike a mountain every day and I'll write a paper summary from there. And that started as a joke, but then became like a ritual of sorts that's been continuing since. So that's how all of this started. Long-winded answer.
So what is like, why is your own personal fascination with LLM? Why is it the emerging properties bit that is really that has captured your imagination? Or do you think if this, I mean, you mentioned how GPT-3 or ChatGPT is nothing but like a bigger model train, and now they've, or do you think, you know, it's going in a place where you keep training these bigger and bigger LLMs, it's going to, I don't know, maybe reach AGI or superintelligence? Is that the path that you're seeing, or why do you think there is so much fascination with these LLMs?
I'm not good at predicting the future, so I don't know if this is the path. I personally really don't care about AGI so much as well. For me, the fascination sort of comes from the aspect of how much you can do with these models, right? Because of their reasoning ability. If you were to build like the best OCR product ever that can become a $1 billion company, you would have to think of so many edge cases, right? But now, even if you connect the like dumbest open source OCR model with a moderately good LLM and prompt it reasonably enough, that is bound to outperform any custom solution that you would have built, at least in my experience. And this is just an example, but this extends to pretty much all AI products, at least in my opinion, that this like central engine that is able to reason and do so many things that we've been trying in different ways. I think it's a really cool thing to experiment and play around with.
Do you have any thoughts on like the LLM? Like, I don't know if these are LLM wars, but every company seems to be training like a larger language model, in a sense. So I think you spoke about Claude 2 was released a few days back. I recently heard that, I think Sundar spoke about in the Google I/O, he spoke about Gemini, that they were training Gemini from the ground up. And I think Demis also kind of alluded to that in an interview he gave recently. Sam alluded in the testimony that they will not begin to train GPT-5 at least for the next 6 months, which means that they'll probably start something in the next 6 months or after that. What do you think about these, and there are various startups training larger models or even smaller models with similar capabilities. So how are you looking at the landscape? What are you finding interesting? What are you finding not very interesting?
Sure. And many people don't realize this, but GPT-4 was ready in August and it was being served to customers in early access in August. And that was the time when 3.5 was just released. So if you watch Khan Academy's founder's talk, he mentions in running that he had early access in August of 2022 to GPT-4.
Uh-huh.
And my personal opinion is GPT-5 or whatever they're going to call it is ready. At least that's my personal hot take, because I don't foresee it's not it not being ready. People are contemplating that GPT-4 plus code interpreter is GPT-4.5 because it's like so much stronger, and I somewhat agree with that. My personal stack of LLMs would be in proprietary ones. Claude 1.3, also I really like that. Claude 2 would be up there. GPT-4 for writing code. And then for open source, H2O GPT, I think, is the best out there.
On open source, like, are you happy with the way that people have been tinkering with models? Like, I'm trying to contrast this with OpenAI, where I think they have refused to kind of share model details and even open source the models. And I think a few players are also moving in that direction where they're not releasing weights of the model or also even model description, like, you know, how much data is it trained on, what's the size of the model, how many layers per se. So are you worried about like the state of open source, or are you optimistic?
It's a very human tendency, isn't it? I don't understand the hate OpenAI gets for it. Like, let's say if you go back to days of college, if you're trying to get a job, you're never going to tell people where you're applying. You're never going to tell people how that interview went or how much you're making, right? At least in our culture, we don't. And then even if you try to get one little detail, yeah, it's going, we're like, I'm able to afford food, that's it. Even though maybe you like have the largest crypto portfolio in your entire neighborhood, right? Because that's your competitive edge and you like want to keep it to yourself, right? And OpenAI found this obviously now valued at $20 billion project, and they had this like direction they could potentially take with it. If I was there, and if I was given the option, I would have taken it much earlier than they did. If I was like leading the project, at least I would have. So I don't understand if anyone else put in that position would have taken a different direction. The hate is around the fact that they had established themselves as this like leading open source agency. But if you, and I actually went back and played all of their interviews from earlier and the principles that they were talking about. And their pivot was actually quite aligned with what they were talking about. So if you watch Greg Brockman's earlier interviews, I don't think the company has done anything that they didn't mention they might. So for me, I don't understand the hate around it. The open source LLMs are really cool. I still think they have like a lot of catching up to do. Because these proprietary ones have so much access to real info, which is like user interactions and user data, that there's this catching up to do. But again, maybe like it's a different market segment altogether, right? GPT-4 can do all of these things. And maybe you just don't need that. Maybe you need a smaller one to solve one small task, and that's all you care about.
Do you think like GPT-4 is like way ahead of its competitors? Like I had watched a video where the largest PaLM model was also like significantly inferior to like in coding, was like at least in coding I remember it was very bad as compared to GPT-4, but also in other aspects it was trailing significantly. Did you notice that as well? Or
I've not used PaLM in a while, so I don't know. So I use Claude 80% of my time, and I default to GPT-4 whenever I'm using it to like get help with code or get it to write code. So that's how I split across these.
Understood. Any thoughts on the, you spoke about DALL-E 2 earlier. Any thoughts on these vision type models? Mid-Journey, have you used Mid-Journey? Any thoughts on that?
So I have the highest subscription tier in Mid-Journey, and that also I run out of images to generate there. And that's like a lot of images. I really like it. I've played around with a lot of text-to-image models. That PC, if I'm not playing games, that's running Stable Diffusion on a constant port all the time. So if I like want to generate something, I can just go there. I mess around with a lot of open checkpoints. I mess around with text to image quite a lot. Haven't played around with text to video so much, but text to image also I'm quite up to date with, at least the checkpoints that are coming out, the research not so much.
Are you generating images for a specific purpose, or are you just playing around? When you're just playing around, is it? I had a friend of mine who was trying to come up with YouTube captions, not YouTube captions, sorry, YouTube thumbnails. But he was not finding, like, he was using Midjourney, but he was not very happy with the outcome. So then he defaulted to, I think, using Canva itself. Yeah.
Nice.
Finally, I want to touch on, you've lost a significant amount of weight, I think, in the past few years. Can you talk a little bit about your process of how much, like, how have you managed to do that?
Yeah, for me, over time, the processes aren't hard. Setting the goal is hard. So committing to the goal is hard. Not pursuing it for me is hard. And over time, I've, like, grown into that mentality. So sometime in 2020, I set the goal to lose weight. And over a period of 2 years, I lost like 36 kgs. That's about 70 pounds plus for my annoying friends. For anything that I end up pursuing, the process, I really don't care about once I, like, commit to the goal. So it's like once I agree to doing it, no matter what it takes, right? And I was, like, sort of started applying that mentality to whatever. So even reading papers, let's say it's like, when I say I've been writing about papers every day, that includes, like, everyday life stuff, right? So, like, also traveling, rain outages, different things happening, even accounting for all of that, I'll still write about papers every day, at least for few more days, just for the kicks of it. I think I plan to do it for 1,000 days every day. So let's see how that goes, which is a large number, right? Like, that's about 3 years. And this sort of, this mentality started with Chai Time Data Science, where I said I'll put out 2 episodes every week, Thursdays and Sundays at one time for an entire year. And I'm sure you know how hard it is to schedule an interview, keep that schedule up, edit, put those out alongside everything else. So since then, like, I've sort of grown into enjoying these, like, incredibly hard goals.
At one point, I think I saw one of your videos where I think you were doing 100 push-ups, 100 squats, and 100, I forget the last one. Were you doing it, like, every day, or was that, like, a time?
Every other day.
Every other day, is it?
Yes.
Man, that I felt like that was so intense, because I have tried doing, like, 100 burpees, and by the end of it, I was ready to puke. So I really was very shocked.
The burpees are hard. I used to do it in sets, so not in one stretch.
Okay, like throughout, like 20 at one point in the day, and then what was that?
No. In one go, in sets, so not like 100 in one go, but like 20 into 5 in like 20 minutes, something like that.
Okay. What does your schedule look like?
So H2O is quite flexible in that way. I think there are meetings and whatnot, but outside of that, since I work remotely, it's quite flexible. If I'm traveling to a customer location, which has been happening quite a lot recently, then it's like an entire day at their offices. Outside of that, let's say for today, we're doing this on a Friday. So I had an 8 a.m. call, then I have a 3 a.m. call and one more in the evening. Outside of that, I'm flexible to plan my schedule.
3 p.m. call, right?
3 p.m., yes. Yeah, not aim. Yeah, so in that sense, the schedule is quite flexible. I start my days early. Nowadays, it's been raining, but ideally, I like to go for a run in the morning if I can. So those are the two fixed things. Everything else sort of keeps changing depending on how the day is going.
Understood. That's all I have for you. Anything I have forgotten to bring up that you would like to touch on?
Not per se. I'd say just if anyone's interested in open source LLMs, check out H2GPT, check out LLM Studio. Both are open source. Both are some of the best, one of the best, if I may, out there. If you're interested in reading papers, I write about them every day on the internet. But no, I quite enjoy the questions. So thanks for all the research. I know you've, like, gone through a lot of stuff. I was, like, quite pleasantly surprised. So thanks for all that.
Thank you for your time.